Cool, thanks very much. So yeah, I'm going to be trying to give you two different studies in incommensurate charge order. It's going to be a bit of a rush, which I don't like to do. But so the first half is kind of some theoretical work. Actually, let me use this hockey stick. I always wanted to use one of these. The first half is going to be this theoretical work, which we published last year in PRL. And what I'd like to show you in the second part, which is going to be shorter, so we'll spend probably the first half an hour on the first part. And then the second part, I'm going to try and show you some very recent experimental results we have, which we believe to be incommensurate charge order. But to give the ending away, it turns out that actually there isn't any incommensurate charge order in the system. But I'll explain that to you, and hopefully it'll be interesting anyway. I believe they were tied together about a week ago, and now we've very recently worked out that they're probably not going to be. But hopefully it'll be fun anyway. So the first half, natural quasicrystals from incommensurate charge order. I'll explain what all those different things mean. It's some work I was doing with my PhD supervisor, Jasper van Wezel, who's now at the University of Amsterdam. So I'm going to switch between the board and the projector, my favorite method of presenting. So it has to do these two things, the quasicrystals and incommensurate charge order. So I think I'll explain what charge order is first. I won't assume everyone knows what it is, but I imagine it's familiar to a few people in the room. So I'm going to be considering 1D systems. So if we have a 1D crystal, we would have some kind of even spacing of atoms along a line, something like this. And they're going to be bonded together somehow. So they're going to share their electrons. And if we were to plot the probability of finding an electron, so proportional to the charge density, we would expect to find something like this. So peaking wherever there's an ion, so these are now positively charged ions, the probability of finding an electron peaks wherever there's an ion, but it's non-zero between the ions, so they're bonded together somehow. Okay, so that's the natural assumption. It turns out that generically in quasi one-dimensional systems, which we can realize in the lab, actually if you cool them down, they'll generally be a temperature below which this story changes. And spontaneously, the electrons will pick some new period. They might do something like this. So realistically, this would be a small modulation on top of this structure that stays approximately the same. But there's some increasing in the periodicity of the electronic structure. So this is known as the Pyles instability. It could be some multiple of the lattice spacing. So it could peak every second site or every third site or so on. And that would be known as a commensurate charge density wave. So kind of like a wave of charge density. Or actually, it could be some irrational multiple of the lattice spacing, in which case it's an incommensurate charge density wave. OK, so that's the one I'll be focusing on today. Just to give a brief explanation as to why this happens, it's actually quite quick to explain. So it's called the Pyles instability. It's most easily thought of if we think in K-space, if we had some kind of nearest neighbor model, we'd have a dispersion that would look something like this. So band structure versus wave vector. Nearest neighbor model, we'd get something a bit like a cosine dispersion. Really doesn't matter at all what the form is. Say we half fill the system, so we're going to fill up to this level. This would be the Fermi level. So these states are filled and these states are empty. Pyles asked the question, what happens if there's some coupling between the states at the Fermi level? So if there's any coupling at all between these two states, we happen to have filled to this level. So the easiest way to see what happens is we work in a reduced Brillouin zone, so we can just backfold, giving us half the K states, and we keep the same physical system by backfolding the second band in. Okay, it's just a mathematical rewriting of the problem. And the reason this is quite a nice way to do it is that now the states that we want to couple sit at the same point in this reduced Brillouin zone. And so when we turn on a coupling from first order perturbation theory, we just get a splitting at the degenerate point, something like this. Okay. So Pyle's argument was that at low enough temperature, the only states that were occupied were below this level. So all the occupied states get pushed down in energy by opening up this gap. And all these states get pushed up in energy, but they're not filled at low temperature. So you always get an energy gain from this. So actually, it doesn't matter what it is that couples these states at the Fermi level. It could be electron-phonon coupling or electron-electron interactions. Any even infinitesimal coupling between these states will always give you an energy gain at low enough temperatures. This is Pyle's argument. So that was half filling, and that the result would be doubling of the period of steam reciprocal space, or halving of it in real space. So this would correspond to a period two charge density wave. So the electrons peaking every other site. And when the ions react to that new potential they're seeing, then they would form into pairs. So they would move away from their original structure into these pairs. Okay. So for different filling fractions, you get different periods of the charge order. And actually, generically, you would expect to get an incommensurate wave vector. So the electron's trying to form a period that's some irrational multiple of the lattice spacing. So I've got some slightly nicer pictures of it up here. So at the top there, we'd have something that's a commensurate period three structure. Again, the blue line showing the charge density, the pink balls, the ions. And so the idea is that the electrons have suddenly picked this new period, and now the ions have to adjust. So I haven't shown the ion adjusting. Okay, and then there's kind of, you know, you do it self-consistently, and the electrons now feel the new potential of the ions, and so on. We go back and forth between them. So this is the first thing that we expect to happen, the electrons adjusting. It could instead pick some incommensurate period. So here I've picked something that's, the idea is it's supposed to be between period three and period four, and it's just sat at some irrational multiple of the spacing. Okay. So we generically expect that the incommensurate wave would form. And what you find in most systems is that when charge order first forms, you get an incommensurate charge density wave. And as you cool down into the ordered state, the wave vector evolves towards a commensurate value. And in a lot of cases, there's then a lock-in transition where the charge order locks into the lattice, and we get some commensurate multiple of the spacing. So I'll explain why that happens shortly. The incommensurate case, while it might form generically, it seems a little bit unphysical. Because if you think about it, if the charge order peaks, if the charge density peaks on one ion, it can never actually peak on another ion again because of the nature of irrational numbers. Right? So the commensurate structure, although it doesn't take full advantage of this Pyle's instability, it does have this property that the charge density peaks on ions. And since the ions are positive and the charge density is negative, this kind of makes physical sense that this is a lower energy state. So the theory of how this really works was come up with by a guy called Macmillan in 1974. And what he proposed is that actually you form something called discommensurations. So a little bit complicated. But the idea was that he wants to come up with some different state that interpolates between these two. And it takes advantage both of the Pyle's instability energy and the commensurate lock-in. So what Macmillan suggested was that an incommensurate charge density wave actually takes the form of a commensurate charge density wave for some section of the lattice. Actually, it would probably be about 100 lattice sites, but I've not shown it here. Something like 100 lattice sites. And then there'll be an abrupt phase slip over something like the period of one atomic spacing, or maybe a few spacings. So it takes advantage of both. On average, it has the wave vector of the incommensurate charge density wave, which is what it needs to take advantage of the Pyle's instability. But locally, it tends to lock into the lattice. But there's an additional energy cost associated with these phase slips that have to come in. So in this picture I've shown in the gray here is the incommensurate charge density wave again. And then in blue is what we might see for these discommensurations. It's a little bit schematic and kind of crammed in to fit on the board. But so these phase slips take the form of solitons. If you look at the free energy hero down that we'll take a look at in a few slides' time, it turns out it's a Sine-Gordon Lagrangian that you're dealing with, and so you get these soliton solutions. So what Macmillan showed is that these solitons repel one another, so you get an evenly spaced lattice of these solitonic phase slips. Okay, so one way to look at this, I'm going to use the other board. A nice way to look at it is to write down the charge density. We'll call it rho of x. Find some order parameter psi. And we can write it as something like this. So just some particular functional form. So if we set k to be, let's call it 2 pi over 3a, so that if delta were 0, we'd just have a period 3 charge density wave here. Okay, so I find it's easier to understand these discommensurations if we look at a function at delta x along the lattice. Okay, so x is just our position along the lattice. So we've set it up so that a commensurate period 3 structure, this delta of x, would just be flat. Okay, we'll set it to 0 everywhere. right? Because k by definition is 2 pi over 3a, so this would give us a wave with period 3. A commensurate period 4 charge density wave would look something like this. So period 3, period 4. Okay, so this one is just some linear function such that the difference of k and this prefactor here is 2 pi over 4a, so a period 4 structure. The incommensurate charge density wave, also linear, it's going to sit somewhere in between the two, because I, by construction I made it somewhere between period 3 and period 4. Okay. So then the idea is that with these discommensurations, we form periods, so it's large sections of the lattice where it's commensurate, period 3, and then we have these phase slips such that the average wave vector matches the incommensurate line. So it's called ICDW for incommensurate charge density wave. And this would be Macmillan's discommensuration states. We'll call it DC. So I've got some slightly nicer pictures of that over here. OK. So it's just another way to say that, again, it takes advantage of both terms and the energy. So it's locally commensurate, but the phase slips give us the average wave vector that we want. OK. So the work I did that I'm going to explain to you now, let me just give kind of the basic argument that made me think of the work that I'll then present. So the idea was that these phase slips kind of look a little bit, they're a bit unseemly, right? And they do have an energy associated with them. So I thought another option might be, if we take the incommensurate case, what would happen if we just took the peaks of the charge density and we shifted them onto the nearest ion? Okay, so they're going to shift in a bit of a strange way, but the result will always be either a section of period 3 or a section of period 4, depending on whether which of the ions it's closest to. Okay, so if that were to happen, then the result would be what I'm going to call a quasicrystal, which I'll explain in a second. So it looks something like this. So it's not quite sinusoidal. It's sections of sinusoidal bits. This is period 4, this one's period 3, this one's 3, 4, and so on. Okay. So this was the idea that motivated the research. I was thinking, okay, so then this structure, it's again locally commensurate with the lattice everywhere. It again has the same average wave vector as the incommensurate case, which is what it wants, but now it doesn't have these phase slips in it. It has some kind of higher order discontinuities in the derivatives, but lower order, it looks a bit nicer. So that was the idea. And if we think about this delta of x construction again, it's a bit harder to draw, but the idea is it's now sections of period 3 and period 4, which again match the delta x for the incommensurate charge density wave. Okay. So that's the motivation. I should make it clear from the start that I'm not the work I'm going to do doesn't actually say whether or not that lining up, the shifting of the peaks, if that's an actual mechanism that causes the formation of these things. I'm just going to look at a free energy in a few slides and show that this can, in some cases, have a lower free energy than the other cases. But this is just the motivation for how I came up with the idea. Okay, so I'm calling it a quasicrystal state. Again, I won't assume anyone knows what quasicrystals are, but in one dimension at least, they're fairly straightforward to understand. So the idea is, the definition I'd like to use is that there's some kind of tiling of a one-dimensional line where we have two or more different unit cells, and they're stuck together in such a way that they don't form any repeating structure, because if they did, then that would just be one big unit cell that repeats. Okay, so we're going to take two in this case, unit cells, stick them together in a pattern that doesn't repeat, but nor is it completely random. And a way to see that it's not random is that the sequence of period 4s and period 3s that's forming here can be constructed by forming this 1D quasicrystal as a slice through a 2D crystal. Okay, and this is actually generic to quasicrystals, that we can form them as slices through higher dimensional crystals. So let me just show you the construction as to how that works. So if we take a 2D crystal, this square lattice, and we draw a line that is, so if this angle is alpha, then tan alpha will be an irrational number, so that the line hits exactly one lattice point and no others. Okay. So we take a second line, parallel to the first, which intersects the opposite corner of the same unit cell. And now, if a point of the 2D lattice falls between the two lines, we'll project it down onto, say, the first line. And you can convince yourself that the result is always two different lengths of unit cell. Actually, it's cos alpha and sine alpha, if that angle's alpha. So two different lengths of unit cell. The pattern of long and short cells never repeats because the repeat distance would be the next time this line intersected the lattice again, but by construction it never does. So it looks kind of random, but you can see that it's clearly not random, because actually if you give me any cell on the thing and I know what the 2D lattice is, then actually I can predict what the other cell will be any distance down the quasicrystal. So it's got this kind of hidden order in it. So this is what I'd use as a definition of a quasicrystal. People disagree on the specific definitions, but it's not a physical disagreement, just a kind of definitional one. When we look at higher dimensional examples, probably the most famous quasicrystal is the Penrose tiling. So this is a 2D quasicrystal. Again, we have two different kinds of unit cell, pink and blue. And again, they're stuck together to form some pattern that fills the space, but it doesn't repeat. There's no larger cell made out of these that can just be tiled in a normal way. But again, you can see there's kind of a hidden order to this thing. It's not completely disordered either. Okay, and I've got another example. It's not a Penrose tiling. It's something that has a kind of sevenfold rotational symmetry to it. Actually, the diffraction pattern has sevenfold rotational symmetry in this. You can see certain sort of sevenfold centers in. So mainly the point of this slide is that they're quite pretty things, these quasicrystals. Okay, so they can exist in one, two, three, or four dimensions. And in the one-dimensional case that I'm considering, I'm suggesting that this construction, which Jasper and I came up with, actually forms one of these 1D quasicrystals, and we showed that in a previous paper. Okay, so that's the kind of setup for the problem. To make it quantitative, we really need to look at a free energy. And the idea was that what McMillan did in 74 was he showed that the commensurate and incommensurate cases tend to have a higher energy than this discommensuration state when he formed this kind of phenomenological free energy that explains the charge ordering transition. So yes.
Discommensuration means that the wave function has to be discontinuous at some point?
It's not really discontinuous. I've shown it as discontinuous, but really it would be spread over maybe a small number of lattice sites. Actually, we'll look at some examples. They look a lot like physical examples in the second half of the talk where they've been seen in an experiment. Turns out they're not, as I said, but they look exactly like what you'd expect for these sorts of things. So I'll show you some pictures of what it should look like. So yeah, this is a bit schematic, but they spread over a small number of lattice sites. Okay, so our idea was to take McMillan's free energy that he used to prove that these discommensurations are lower energy than the other two examples, just take his free energy and stick in this new ansatz and show that it's lower energy than the case he was considering. Now that didn't work, but we had to consider a slightly more general free energy. Actually, the reason it didn't work was just that McMillan had he'd formed his free energy assuming that his charge order was going to be approximately period 3, but slightly larger, but kind of close to it. So we wanted just an even more generic free energy. So let me kind of talk you through the terms here. Okay, the first one to get rid of, this one here, just keeps the free energy bounded. We're not too fussed about it in terms of the physics of what's going on. The first term here gives us, this gives an energetic gain for the piles instability. So let me okay, just write a definition down on the board for you. So this chi of q I'm going to refer to here, and again later, the susceptibility towards formation of these charge density waves takes this form. So it's also called the Lindhard function in linear response theory. Okay, we'd add some regularization, which I'm not going to bother writing up, and we don't use a minus sign. Okay, so this psi of k is the band structure, Fermi functions, and what we see is that when psi k equals psi k plus q, the denominator goes to zero, and this thing would diverge. These Fermi functions actually keep us restricted towards the Fermi level, which makes sense. That's the thing you're usually interested in kinetic matter, right? So when does psi k equals psi k plus q? That's when there's some fixed vector connecting the points on the Fermi surface. So this, the form of this, actually, let me show you some pictures, which you don't have to worry about too much for now. The generic form of this chi of k in 1D would look something like this black line. So it diverges at a certain wave vector. With the regularization, it kind of stops it from hitting infinity, but it still blows up here. And then this wave vector would be the wave vector of the incommensurate charge density wave. Okay, so the first term gives us an energetic gain if we have a wave vector associated close to the charge density wave wave vector. The final term here, which is a slight generalization of Macmillan's, gives us, so it's sum over n, n is an integer, so it gives us a lock-in to the lattice at period n. It's not immediately obvious how that works, so we're substituting in this row of x that I have written down over here. You have to use your kind of cosine rules, your multi-angle things, and you can convince yourself with a bit of algebra that actually the nth term gives you an energetic gain for a lock-in to the lattice of period n. So again, I'm going to keep considering a charge density wave that's trying to have an incommensurate wave vector between period 3 and period 4. So it's n equals 3 and n equals 4 that's of interest up here. Capital K here now is just the reciprocal lattice vectors. So we're just doing a generic expansion in those. So we've got umlaut terms in there as well, but they're not too important. Okay, so we've written down this fairly generic free energy which captures the physics of the charge density wave transition. Probably the best picture to look at is this one over here. So I'll talk you through all the different terms on that. So these are the results of sticking in these different ansatzes into the model. Okay, so we've got free energy as a function of this psi C3 over A. So it's basically the period 3 lock-in energy, but written in a dimensionless form. So Q equals a third here. This is a period 3 charge density wave. So we've got a straight line. It's linear in C3, clearly. We're just getting an energetic gain for period 3 lock-in, and as that lock-in energy goes up, then the period 3 charge density wave does better and better. Q equals a quarter is the period 4 charge density wave. That's also a straight line. So any period 4 structure is going to gain from a period 3 lock-in because they have a common ratio at period 12, right? So every 12th one, it gets an energy gain. So the period 4 charge density wave also gains linearly, but it's never as good as the period 3 because we're just considering the period 3 lock-in. The incommensurate charge density wave here, ICDW, is just a horizontal line. So the reason for that is that it never gets any energy gain from an increasing period 3 lock-in because it doesn't lock into the lattice. So we're imagining a purely incommensurate charge density wave. It has no interest in locking to the lattice at all. But its energy is initially a lot lower because it's taking advantage of this first term, which the period 3 lock-in has nothing to do with. Okay, so the incommensurate charge density wave can take advantage of the Pyle's instability, but it doesn't get any gain from locking into the lattice, so it's horizontal here. So this explains my statement earlier, where I was saying that generally what you see in an experiment is the formation of an incommensurate charge density wave, then the evolution of the vector towards commensurate. So this psi is the order parameter. We expect this to be zero in the disordered state, becoming non-zero at the transition, and then increasing in magnitude as you go into the ordered state. So as we go deeper into the transition at lower temperatures, we move from left to right, and the incommensurate charge order at some point is overtaken by the period 3 structure. So we get a lock into the lattice. So Macmillan's discommensurations, DC, the blue curve, what he did was he did it numerically, and he used a variational ansatz that allowed the formation of these solitonic phase slips. So actually, by nucleating phase slips, he can smoothly interpolate between incommensurate order and commensurate. Okay, so at very large values of this C3, the discommensurations can mimic the period 3 charge density wave. So they end up, actually those lines end up being parallel to each other at larger values. But it's made energy gain because at lower values, when the period 3 is, we just set it to be 0 by definition, but it's not being able to take advantage of any lock-in. When we set the lock-in energy to 0, the discommensurations can just change their form, and they can approximate an incommensurate charge density wave. So it starts off as the incommensurate case, and then it smoothly interpolates into the commensurate case by nucleating these solitonic phase slips. And so he just solves self-consistently for the spacing of the solitons and the width and so on, and so they can always take full advantage of the free energy he wrote down. And they've been seen in an experiment in many different systems. Okay, so our proposal, this quasi-crystal case, the idea is that we have sections of period 3 and sections of period 4. So actually, it's a straight line again, and the gradient is a kind of weighted average of these two gradients. So the reason for that is, again, you want to try and make the average wave vector, which is the incommensurate charge density wave. So we have some weighted sum of these. So it's just how many period 3s and period 4s appear overall. So at very large values of C3, actually, it's going to lose out to the period 3 because it's got some period 4s that do worse. at very low values, it's able to do better than the any of the commensurate ones because it has the it takes advantage of the Pyle's instability, has the right wave vector on average. Quite what's happening here is probably easiest to think of by looking again at this susceptibility. So it's a bit of a tricky argument, but I'll just talk through it. So the rho of q is just the Fourier transform of our order parameter rho of x. So the idea is that when we sat at, so say we've got zero lock-in energy, and we're just trying to take advantage of this Pyle's instability. The incommensurate charge density wave just has one one big peak in its Fourier spectrum sat at exactly QCDW, the wave vector of the incommensurate charge density wave. So we have this chi of Q with a little bit of width, and the incommensurate charge density wave has just one big peak sat in the middle of chi of Q. So it takes full advantage of it. In the discommensuration state, initially that takes the form of the incommensurate charge density wave, so it has that one big peak. But as we start increasing the tendency towards wanting to lock into the lattice at period 3, it starts nucleating its phase slips in order to approximate that. And so what happens is that you still have a big peak at the incommensurate value, but you start growing peaks at different points in the Fourier spectrum. Okay, so the diffraction pattern of a quasicrystal is a bit of an interesting thing. When I showed you that construction for making a 1D quasicrystal as a slice through a 2D crystal, you can make the diffraction pattern of a 1D quasicrystal by taking the Fourier transform of the entire 2D space and then projecting it down onto a line. So in real space, the quasicrystal is a slice through a higher dimensional crystal. In reciprocal space, it's a projection of all the points. So the result is that you get a dense covering of the space, as you'd expect from projecting a higher dimensional space onto a lower one. But it's not just kind of flat and dense like you get for a disordered system, it has Bragg peaks in it still. So it has both Bragg peaks and a kind of dense background. So it's a bit of a funny thing. And that's actually the trick to how it's able to win in the intermediate regime. So at low values of lock-in and high values, the discommensurations always win. The quasicrystal can win in intermediate values. And the way it works is to do with the statistics of these peaks in the Fourier pattern. So it again has its biggest peak at the incommensurate charge density wave ordering vector. It has, again, satellite peaks, these little Bragg peaks that come out of the dense background. But it turns out that the statistics are a bit different to those of the discommensurations, and the discommensuration peaks tend to repel a bit. So if you have a big peak in the discommensuration Fourier transform, then it tends to repel other bigger peaks. The quasicrystal structure seems to have around big peaks, it's allowed, the others are allowed to cluster a bit more around it.
So is there a blue peak underwriting the
under the pink one, yeah, that's right.
Under the black one.
Yeah, sorry, that's supposed to be clear. So if it looks kind of purple, that's because there's blue and pink together. So that happens here as well, for example, whereas this is just pink and this is just blue. Yeah, so this is both pink and blue having a peak there. Thanks, good question. Okay, so it's a bit of an interesting bit of math to do with the distribution of the peaks in Fourier space that allows the quasicrystal to do energetically better in the intermediate regime. Okay, and then I've got a kind of phase diagram here. This is period 3 lock-in energy versus period 4 lock-in energy. It's not so important, but the idea is that these DC3 and DC4 are discommensurations approximating a period 3 and period 4 structure. They're obviously the same phase because it's just changing the distribution size of the phase slips. But there's a region where the quasicrystal is of lower energy. Okay, so I'll just kind of talk you through the main points of that. That's really the whole talk of this theoretical part. So the main points are these. So quasicrystalline ground states are actually expected for many incommensurate charge density waves. So it hasn't been noticed before quite why this is. There's a number of reasons. One might be that we haven't really put much physical meaning to this C3. This is just some period 3 lock-in to the lattice. But we haven't given a physical mechanism as to like where that energy is coming from and how to predict it for real systems. So it could be, and I think it's probably fairly likely, that we actually sit quite low down on this plot. So when I said it's intermediate values of this C3 that gives us the quasicrystal, that's potentially actually very large values of this object, depending on like where that physically comes from. But nevertheless, it does seem that there's a large region of the parameter space for this fairly generic free energy that the quasicrystals do better than the incommensurate charge density waves.
strictly one-dimensional argument here, right?
This is still in 1D. Yeah.
So can you extend to 2 and 3D? What happens?
That's hard to say. You know, when I say 1D, I'm meaning quasi-1D, obviously. So, you know, systems that are 3D materials, but they have strong bonding along chains and weak bonding between chains, these are known to charge order and do follow the properties I was saying earlier.
But let's say you move from 1D to quasi-1D and start to look at cross-chain coupling.
Yeah.
So the positive instability is force in 1D, but it's not the case in 2 and 3D. It's threshold.
That's right.
So what happens in if you start including like some kind of interchain infield way,
yep.
Is there a way to convince yourself that you can still have the quasi-crystal that survived? Maybe because it's a finite energy difference.
Yeah, actually, we consider this a bit, and you actually do need to have a quasi-1D system. So there are these kind of fancy arguments, like if you look at renormalization group analysis in true 1D systems, you can show that the Luttinger liquid should probably beat the charge ordering at low values of the coupling. It's an argument I'm not too concerned about because no like physical system is really 1D. But you do require this argument that actually it's truly a quasi 1D system, and so that's where that's why we don't see just Luttinger liquids in any 1D system. So you've already got that. Also, when I've drawn this peak here as having a finite width, that width could, for example, be coming from the fact that you don't have a truly 1D system. So strictly you might actually for 1D you'd expect like a delta function here. I've put some broadening over here. Well, I haven't written it down, but we'd expect this to broaden. That could come from interchain coupling, for example. So I think really actually you do want a quasi 1D system, which is helpful. Another good question. Okay. So now that we're getting these quasi crystalline ground states for 1D systems, it actually greatly extends the number of known naturally occurring quasicrystals. So at present, there are only 2 known naturally occurring quasicrystals. There are plenty of quasicrystals we can make in the lab, but the 2 known examples came out of the same Siberian meteorite, which is very exciting stuff, but I'm not going to have time to relate the story. But the idea is that actually, if you look very closely at 1D systems, you should see that there are actually a larger number of natural quasicrystals. One major reason this probably hasn't been seen, aside from the fact it hadn't really been proposed, is that the natural place to look for this is in real space. So the real smoking gun of it is if you see a period 3 cell next to a period 4 cell, then that doesn't happen in the discommensuration state. So just seeing that straight away tells you that you've got, well, it would be consistent with the quasicrystal. But that requires you to look in real space, and you need very clean direct probes in real space, which you don't really have. Charge ordering studies tend to look in reciprocal space, where you can see the wave vector very clearly.
So it doesn't have to be 3 and 4. You might expect that, 1 and 2 or lower wave vector would be.
Yeah, totally.
So 3 and 4 is just for argument's sake.
Just for argument's sake, yeah. And from comparison to Macmillan's study, where he picked something slightly larger than period 3, I think he then compared it to a real system that had something that was close to period 3. I think it was tantalum disulfide or something like that. But yeah, any period we're doing, probably 1 and 2, is just easy to see. Okay, and the final argument is that the free energy is fairly generic that we wrote down, and it doesn't just apply to charge-ordered systems. In theory, it could apply to other incommensurate systems where you have 2 irrationally related periods. So we put some fairly mad hypothetical examples in the paper. Okay, we're doing okay for time. So that's the first half of the theoretical study. The second half of the talk is going to be about some experimental results we've seen. So I'd quite like to push on with them just so we don't run out of time. We're only kind of halfway through the talk. But I can take some questions now if they're kind of pressing, if anyone's completely not understood anything or if there's anything people really want to ask. Otherwise, I'm happy to go on and show you some experimental results.
Especially because, for example, quarter ring and you know, taking the interaction. So your electron interaction can also produce charge ordering in 1D.
Yeah, at a quarter filling.
Quarter.
Yeah. So actually, if you P over Q fill the system with P and Q integers, then you get a period Q charge density wave. So a quarter filling will give you a period 4, for example. 3-quarter filling would also give a period 4. Yeah, you can. Lots of examples are seen in nature. It tends to be fairly low denominator ones, just because it's hard to distinguish like when you get to higher denominators. But yeah, you can form that. Does that answer the question? Okay. I should hand this out. So I can't show you a quasi-crystal, unfortunately. I kind of wanted to. That would have been a nice thing to hand out. It's good to hand things out in talks, I think. I don't have a quasi-crystal for you, but what I did manage to locate is some metallic glass, which shares a lot of properties with quasi-crystals. So this is a metal in the sense that it's a conductor of heat and electricity and so on, and clearly shiny and that sort of thing. But on the atomic scale, it's disordered. So this is somewhat like a quasi-crystal, which they tend to look very much like metals, but on the atomic scale, they're kind of disordered, but they have this hidden order in them. So this doesn't have the hidden order, but it does have a number of interesting properties. Apparently, it's more bouncy than normal metals and that sort of thing. So I'd hand it out, just so you've got something to take a look at. I'm going to have to... So I got this from a company called Liquid Metal. It's based down in California. They very kindly gave me that sample, an offcut from some stuff they were doing. So they make stuff out of these disordered metals. Sorry I couldn't get you a quasi-crystal, but I think this should do for something to look at. Okay, let me push on to the second half then, and I'll take questions at the end. So in the second half of this study, it's called incommensurate charge order in molybdenum diselenide. And just to reiterate, actually, there isn't going to be any incommensurate charge order, but about a week and a half ago, we thought there was. And hopefully I'll convince you why we thought there was. It wasn't a silly thing to think, but I'll give you the resolution at the end there. So this is some work I've been doing with these guys at the Lawrence Berkeley National Lab. Alex Faber-Bargioni there is the head of the group. Sebastian Wickenberg is kind of the lead author on the project, but he's now moved out of academia, working in big data. And Sarah Bayer, she's the lead author on the paper that I'm going to be citing repeatedly. So a lot of the results I'm going to show you now are from Nature Physics paper these guys have already published. We got brought in after that to explain these potential solitons that they're seeing. The theorists on it are myself, Adolfo Grushin here, my friend, and Joel Moore, who's our supervisor at Berkeley. Okay. These results are coming from this paper cited down here. I'll give you references again at the end. So this is very nice work that they've just had published. They use STM and AFM, so scanning tunneling microscopy, atomic force microscopy. So they can look on the atomic scale at various systems. STM, it's generally kind of said that it's a measure of the charge density. Actually, it's a measure of the local density of states, and that's going to be important shortly. So it's very nice, and you often see these pictures of like atoms on the atomic scale using STM. But one disadvantage to STM is that you have to set your probe bias voltage, right? And so it doesn't really distinguish between filled states and empty states. Depending on your bias voltage, you can view empty states or full states, and it won't really tell you which ones you have. So while it might be showing you a picture of what the electronic structure looks like, it might also just be showing you unoccupied states. It might be filling the states and looking at them. So with their combined probe, they can see STM, and they can also see AFM. That's really telling you the positions of the atoms. So when you put the two together, you can see things like charge order, where you're seeing some kind of modulation of the atomic structure, or the electronic structure forming some multiple of the atomic structure. So it's a very nice probe for looking at these systems. What I'm showing here is these are images on this molybdenum diselenide. So it's actually, they can form monolayers of it. So it's a quasi-2D thing in general, so layered material. And actually, we can make single monolayers of it. The results they show in this Nature Physics paper are that they're seeing something called a mirror twin boundary. So if I just kind of show you, so it's a hexagonal material. So if I draw kind of a few unit cells here, the structure is this. We have molybdenum sat on these sites. And then we'd have seleniums above and below the plane on half the interstitial sites. So say this half, okay? And you'd make a lattice like that. What they're looking at is these things called mirror twin boundaries that occur naturally in this material, or in monolayers at least. So if we put a mirror twin boundary along here, when we draw our hexagon over here, the molybdenums occupy the same sites. So they form a continuous hexagonal lattice across the whole system. Nothing changes in the mirror twin boundary. But now the seleniums occupy the other half of the site. So it would go on these three, but actually it goes above and below the plane on these three sites. Okay. So here's an example of it. So here's, again, AFM and STM, and they look like this in STM, so they're very clear. And so inside this triangle here, we'd have the seleniums above and below, half the interstitial sites. Outside the triangle, it's the other half. Okay. So it forms a 1D boundary within this 2D system. And very interestingly, I find that molybdenum diselenide is a direct gap semiconductor. But along these mirror twin boundaries, they find that actually they get conducting edge states. So that's kind of a common thing to see these days, because you're all into topological stuff and you tend to get edge states. But there's no actual, they're not topologically protected edge states. Adolfo actually has a good argument as to where they come about from. But the interesting thing is that we form these 1D edge states in these little triangles. But even more interesting than that, so again, this is just some results from that same paper. I won't go through them in too much detail, but what they're seeing is that in these edge states that they form, so conducting edge states across this gap, actually, the being a 1D system, these things are charge ordering. So that's kind of interesting. You don't tend to think of edge states charge ordering, but they have good evidence for it here. They see a charge density wave gap opening up, so they've got some comparison between their STM and some ab initio results. And in ab initio, they've modeled this by just, they kind of put in by hand a distortion of the ion lattice and groups them into threes, make this period three charge density wave, and they get a very nice match between what they see in experiment. So there's some good evidence, and it's well argued in the paper, that what they're seeing is molybdenum diselenide in bulk, as in on most of the 2D surface, direct gap semiconductor. Along these mirror twin boundaries, we get a conducting edge state. And then actually that edge state then charge orders at a low enough temperature. And they seem to see a period three modulation in the charge density corresponding to it. So it's really nice work. So what they brought us in on is these are now new results that are not published. So this is STM. Along the mirror twin boundary, so along those triangles I showed before. And so depending on different bias voltages, so it's 50 millivolt, doesn't matter too much. Here we're seeing this period three structure. So if I showed you the atoms, we'd have about three atoms to each of these peaks. This is a very clean period three charge density wave. But at different bias voltages, we see things like this. So to answer an earlier question, this is the sort of thing you'd expect to see. If we were plotting charge density, this is what you'd see if you looked at one of those discommensurations. Okay, so it kind of looks like the amplitude just dipped down and comes up. I should mention this is just completely raw data. All they've taken is that image and just looked at the intensity profile along it.
This is STM, right?
This is STM, that's right. So we've got a dip in the amplitude, but corresponding to that dip in the amplitude, if we plot the phase, so I've just put a constant sine wave in the background. So at the top, perfect sine wave. For these two, it matches at the end, but then in the middle, it kind of goes a bit out of phase. And actually, the dips in intensity correspond to 2 pi over 3 phase slips. So that's exactly the sort of thing we'd expect to see if we're plotting charge density with Macmillan's discommensuration theory. So this looks very nice. We think they brought us in saying, can you explain this? And we said, yes, this looks like you're not really getting period 3 charge density waves. You're getting something close to period 3, and it's you're able to see it in real space on this small scale. So actually, you're imaging the solitonic phase slips for the first time.
Does this charge ordering mean that these edges are not topologically protected?
They're not topologically protected, that's right.
Is it not topologically insulated?
No. No, so these it's just a normal semiconductor. Molybdenum diselenide. I forget Adolfo's argument as to why we get these edge states. It's not a topological thing, but there's a certain symmetry that's approximate, and it leads to these things. But yeah, actually, disorder will disrupt the edge states and so on. So they're not topologically so exciting. Yeah, thanks for clarifying. Okay, to make this phase argument a bit clearer, actually, if I show you, so this is a 2 pi over 3 phase slip. If I show you a pi phase slip, this is at a different bias voltage. If I again plot the sine wave, I can match it on the left here, and then it goes a bit funny, the STM data, and then clearly we're completely pi out of phase on the right there. But probably the more correct way to do it is to match it on the ends. So on one of these triangles, they have good evidence that actually the electrons sat in on this edge of the triangle can't sort of feed round to the other side. So we want to think of fixed boundary conditions. It's just like sets of 1D systems constrained at the end. Okay, so if we plot it, if we match the sine wave up at the end, we just kind of get some phase ambiguity in the middle, but you can see that it really corresponds to a pi phase slip. The other one was 2 pi over 3. So it does look very much like there's phase slips going on, and we've got this these solitons forming. So we thought we'd model this with the theorist's favorite model, so a 1D system. We need to work in real space, so we have so electron creation operator on site I. So we've got this hopping term. We'll take it to be nearest neighbor. Spinless fermions, spins just add a factor of 2 everywhere. So it's a simple Hubbard model. Between neighboring, if we put electrons on neighboring sites, there's this, we'll call it Coulomb repulsion, so it's only nearest neighbor. With energy G. And then we have these on-site potentials. And we set these to 0 everywhere in the system, except for on the ends where we set them large, so constraining the electrons to live in the system. So it's about the most simple 1D model we could have come up with. It's over a finite number of sites. So when you consider charge density waves, you usually think about an infinitely large system. So they have the Pyle's instability lives in K-space, right? It has a very well-defined wave vector. So you need an infinitely large system to make a very well-defined wave vector. We need to work in a finite size system. We're looking at systems that are maybe 30 to 60 atoms long. So exact results aren't really possible. We can model it numerically. We can solve with mean field theory. I'll just flash this up. I was told to always put some equations in the talk to make it look like I've done some work rather than just showing nice pictures. But we're not too fussed about exactly how we solved it. It's mean field theory, and we did it numerically. The point is that although we pick this particular interaction term, when you treat it in the mean field, with the mean field, then it could be any form. It would take exactly the same form if you use electron-phonon coupling. So both the bond strengths and the on-site potentials both renormalize as you solve self-consistently. Okay, so this particular form of interaction doesn't matter too much. You can just think of any generic interaction given the strength G. So if you think about some different limits of the model, for very large G over T, the system becomes kind of effectively classical. So if you say 1/3 fillet, you want to put electrons every 3 sites, and they are very well localized. And if you make G over T very small, then the kinetic term is the important one, and the system kind of becomes more quantum. So actually, the large G limit, if you look at this order parameter, you can kind of convince yourself this is related to the charge density wave gap, the Pyle's instability. So large G favors charge density wave formation, whereas very small G, you start to get into a quantum well scenario. Same with large system size. Large system size favors charge density wave formation. Small system size, the dominant energy becomes the confining potential at the end, and you start to form a quantum well again. So the reason quantum wells are kind of worth mentioning here is that other groups have argued against the Nature Physics paper saying that they're not really seeing a charge density wave, they're just seeing a quantum well forming by having a small system and just kind of filling non-interacting electrons into the system. That's one method of getting those results. So I think the existence of a charge density wave gap in that system really shows that they are certainly seeing a charge order. You might think it's a bit weird to say, why would you suggest a quantum well when clearly they're seeing a period 3 modulation that looks very much, and a 1/3 filling? That's exactly what you expect for a charge density wave. But actually, if you put if you 1/3 fill a finite number of sites and make it into a quantum well, you actually get some kind of modulation on the charge density, which also has the same number of peaks that you get for the corresponding charge density wave. If that makes sense. This kind of makes sense if you think if you have an infinitely large system and form a period 3 charge density wave, now you start making the system smaller and smaller, there's got to be some kind of crossover where eventually you switch to a quantum well. But what happens to the charge density modulation? So you can convince yourself that if just counting the number of electrons you put in there and thinking about simple quantum well physics, where you get sine waves and you're adding them up, actually, although the physical mechanisms from quantum wells and charge density waves are very different, the end result of what you'd measure in terms of looking at charge density is the same. You get some kind of periodic modulation, and it has the same number of peaks in total in both systems. Okay. So let me get to the point, or rather the new point, that's changed fairly recently. We were kind of imagining that STM is measuring the charge density. That's sort of the sort of thing you just kind of think about without thinking too much. So charge density can be measured by this. So this is the expectation value of the number operator. So n here is the energy eigenstate, and x projecting you onto real space. So the charge density would be given by the sum over occupied levels up to the level you're looking at. Okay? Whereas actually STM measures the local density of states. And that's actually given by this expression. So it's very similar, but you don't look at all occupied levels, you just look at the energy level at your bias voltage. So say you're looking at, say you really do have a quantum well system, then the local density of states, you set your bias voltage, and you just measure the energy eigenstate at that level. Okay? So it turns out this is the trick to explaining what look like those solitons. If we take the limit where we have a very small g of a t, or g of a t equals 0.1, so we're in the kind of the quantum well regime, we put 15 electrons in 45 sites, so that's exactly one-third filling. But as I said before, STM doesn't really care what your filling is. It can measure occupied or unoccupied states. So we'll just set our bias voltage to look at the 15th energy eigenvalue, and we've set g of a t so that we have a quantum well. So we get some sinusoidal modulation. Well, that's good. That's what we expect for quantum wells, right? The solutions are sine waves. But you're always going to get a sine wave if you do this. You'll never see a soliton as a solution to just a simple quantum well, right? I mean, this is just second year undergraduate stuff. So Adolfo had this idea that perhaps the energy resolution on the STM is such that you could include two different energy eigenstates in the same measurement. So perhaps you're measuring both the 14th and 15th energy levels, and just sticking that into the calculation, or you can just do it by hand, you can just, you know, it's just adding up two sine waves, you find that what you get, it looks like this, which looks worryingly like our pi phase slip situation. And even worse, if we add up three energy levels, 14th, 15th, and 16th, we get something that looks like this. And so you're seeing the diminishing in the amplitude. And again, if I plot the phase, it comes out looking exactly like what I showed you before. So one energy level in the quantum well, clearly a sine wave. Two of them, we get a pi phase slip. And three of them, we get these two pi over three phase slips. So actually, what we think is happening is this. At the top here, this is, again, experimental data. Sebastian's kind of probed the system such that he's kind of emphasized these peaks away from the Fermi level. So usually you look over here. But if we look at different bias voltages, we see this series of evenly spaced peaks. And evenly spaced peaks is what you expect for a quantum well, if you have linear dispersion. So what we're thinking is probably something like this. So just to reiterate, I've kind of drawn this myself. I'm not saying this corresponds to the experiment exactly, but say we had a width of energies that we're measuring in STM that looks something like this. So in this region, say we're just measuring this one peak. STM measures something like this. The argument's a bit schematic. This is not the correct bias voltage, but this just to give you the general idea. So STM sees this, the bottom two, and then on the settings I just showed you, the 15th energy level would look something like this. So a nice match, both sine waves. If we move the measurement along, it's got the same uncertainty in the energy. So maybe we can encompass two peaks over here, and then STM measures this, and we would see something like this. Okay, they look a bit different, but if you look at the phase profile, they're kind of similar. But I think the real killer is when we include three peaks like this. So then I'm imagining we're just about summing these three. The bottom two are STM, raw data again, and this is the result of our calculation. You can see it's exactly the same, right? You could have just changed them and not tell the difference. So this seems pretty convincing to us. We think, actually, we're not really seeing solitons in the system. It looked like we were, but actually what we're seeing is just...
What's the resolution, the measurement?
So we've checked with Sebastian, and we suggested... So we estimated what it would need to be for this to be true by trying to say, can we encompass three peaks? And we took those data to him, and he thinks, actually, it's same order of magnitude, at least. So... I don't have a specific number for you, but we checked with him, and he thinks this is plausible as an argument. So
what, a few hundred MeV?
I guess depending on different setups. I mean, on this one, it does, like, I've just drawn this picture myself. This is not coming, these are experimental data. I've just drawn this error bar. I think depending on the exact system they're using, like how many atoms it's got in it and so on, I'm not sure. That would be a few hundred MeV, certainly, but that sounds a bit big, doesn't it? I think that's too big for what we'd expect to be their own resolution.
It sounds
a bit huge.
It sounds large.
Yeah, it does. So I think probably not in this exact thing that I've drawn here. This is just, think of it as schematic. But when we're seeing this one, I guess what they've got a bias is 110 MeV.
This resolution must depend on the precise end of the tip, right? From an instrument to an instrument, you would have a different.
resolution, right?
Yeah, I think that sounds about right.
So are these experiments reproducible then? Or I guess they work with an STM and that STM is, they never crash the STM in the substrate.
No, they've not done that. So I didn't emphasize this earlier, but they have this STM tip, and they've got this nice technique where they put a carbon monoxide molecule on the end of the STM tip. So this is how they do the AFM measurement. But they do both AFM and STM with the same tip. They just kind of operate in different methods. So I think that it's physically one tip, and it's got this carbon monoxide molecule on the end. So they're certainly not smashing it into the thing. But that's about the extent of my knowledge of the experimental system. I might be able to answer some more questions at the end if I can look stuff up. Okay, but so I mean, this argument we really came up with kind of a week and a half ago, but I thought I'd just present you with the result we think we're going to go with. So the question then is it all a complete waste of time? We don't really have solitons. Is there anything interesting in the system beyond what they've already seen? And we think that actually there is. So if we look at G over T, the energy eigenvalues in the system as a function of G over T, if we send G over T to be very small, we're in the quantum well regime, and then we'd get evenly spaced peaks, and that's what I was showing you biases away from the filling fraction. But if you make G over T very large, then you'd go into the charge density wave regime, and you get this big gap opening up, right? Here's the Pyle's instability at a third filling. In intermediate regimes, then it's not clearly a charge density wave mechanism or a quantum well. There's a kind of crossover. And this crossover is a pretty basic thing that you'd have thought would be covered in kind of low-level quantum mechanics courses, but it hasn't been covered because I think the reason is that there's not been this clean experimental system to see it before. So actually, it's quite a nice example of this. We think we have to be sat below 1 in G over T. We're in the quantum well regime, which we can tell by the fact that these peaks are evenly spaced away from the Fermi level. But actually, the peak spacing is not even around the Fermi level. There's a larger gap at the where the charge density wave is opening up. So we have a quantum well, but we also have a significant component of charge density wave in there as well, which we can tell from this gap. So we're sat kind of in the most interesting part of this diagram. We're sat at G over T is smaller than 1, but fairly close to it. Okay, so let me just wrap up, and then I'll take lots of questions, hopefully. So these mirror twin boundaries form small enough systems that the charge density wave to quantum well crossover becomes important. And I think this is something that's not really been studied before because people haven't had access to these nice, clean, small systems, and they haven't had accurate enough probes that can see both the local density of states and the atomic positions and so on. What we thought were solitons, actually mostly due to the local density of states seeing sums of different quantum well states, the quantum well regime being G over T smaller than 1. But at the same time, there is a charge density wave gap. So we're sat probably at the most interesting point in the diagram. We're sat in G over T is smaller than 1, the quantum well regime, but at the point where the charge density wave has become significant as well. Okay, so just to wrap up, here are some references. So on the second part, this Nature Physics paper that you've already had published showing the formation of charge density waves inside these mirror twin boundaries. In the first part, the majority of the talk is based on this PRL, which goes through pretty much the arguments I gave you. There's a couple of other previous papers we had for a bit of background there that kind of gave us the idea in the first place. Great. Okay. With that, I'll thank you for your time. Okay. Questions? Yes, Jeff.
So these mirror twin boundaries, they can be different lengths?
Yes.
So could there be the spacing between these levels should also depend on the size of the well, right?
Yeah, that's right. If we're a quantum well, yeah, in fact, in both cases, but yeah, certainly in the quantum well.
So can you see something in the systematics, like given a fixed energy resolution, if you can shrink the well,
yeah,
could you resolve it better and not get these phase flips?
Yeah, very good question. So we've asked them this. I mean, they're still kind of getting results in. So actually, Sebastian's checking exactly what you're asking now, checking the energy levels as a function of well size, because that's an obvious thing to check. I think, honestly, it's a bit tricky because he's kind of, you know, he's on his big data stuff now and is working for a company, and they're making him turn up and stuff. So we're waiting for those results to come in, but it's certainly something we're checking. While the results are reproducible, you know, we're still looking at raw data here, which hasn't been kind of checked. So we tend to get, like, sometimes they'll see phase slips and sometimes not, even in systems that in mirror twin boundaries that are of the same length, for example. And In fact, as they, even making one measurement, they have to scan the tip across the well, right? And actually they can see suddenly there'll be a jump, and now they're seeing something different in the second half to the first half. So originally the theory was that they were kind of doping the system by using the STM, but we've kind of moved away from that now, and we think that that's probably not the case, but things can even change within the same system as a function of time. So it's pretty, they're pretty new results. So I'll have more answers for you in a few weeks, hopefully. Okay, yeah, yes?
If you take the spin into account, should there be some spin density wave?
Potentially, yeah. We haven't really considered the spin density wave, but that's a good idea. And actually, yeah, we've got some ideas for further work involving spins.
Is there any experimental evidence for this?
For a spin density wave as opposed to a charge density wave? No, I mean, they both form periodic modulations to the structure and so on. No, we haven't seen any need to consider spins over charges, and charges are a bit easier to deal with, but it's certainly like an interesting avenue of inquiry. And they, some other work they've done has involved magnetic impurities in the system. So they're thinking about now trying to find cases of the mirror twin boundary sat near magnetic impurities to try and see things such as spin density waves and so on. But it's not something we've looked into so far. But yeah, interesting question. Yes?
Questions. First of all, about Siberian meteorites.
Oh, yes.
How did they measure this? Determine this
cause of this?
Was it X-ray?
Yeah, so X-ray diffraction showed it. So when you look at, so they're 3D charge density waves. And I think, so you look for these forbidden rotational symmetries in them, right? And I think one has 8-fold rotational symmetry and one has 10-fold. I think that's the case.
I'm surprised you call it natural quasicrystal.
Oh, what, their one or our one?
Right. And the second question, this dependence on the voltage that you showed with this STM.
Yes.
And this basis. And corresponding AFM image doesn't show any differences at all.
Sorry, what doesn't?
So corresponding, like I'm trying to discover the effect of the voltage itself.
Okay, yes.
Yeah.
What's
if your usual corresponding AFM images?
Yes.
And they don't change AFM images. So if you, for example, use this STM, change the voltage, run it for some time, and then do AFM.
Yeah. I don't think that would change it.
Is it used in the crystal, or is it simply effect of the probe that applies high voltage, because voltage is quite high there? Hundreds millivolts?
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, AFM, you're not tunneling things into the system, right? So it's a different mode of operation. So I think AFM will probably just see the same thing. But you're thinking maybe you're affecting the system by...
Is it the crystal itself, or is it perturbations that you induce with the probe?
Yeah, I see. Good. So that's kind of what I was suggesting to Jeff. This was a previous idea that Sebastian had, that perhaps we're actually doping the system by using the STM tip. That's actually been the working hypothesis for the first few weeks. I think now, like, there's that picture of the sum of the three sine waves that looks very much like the thing they're seeing in STM that really has convinced me that probably we're just seeing quantum well states. But I know the experimental guys are still thinking that they might be affecting the system by using these large bias voltages. So it's still something we're considering, but... my personal opinion is probably, I'm sure it would have an effect on the system, but in STM at least, I think they're probably just probing these quantum well states. But it's still an option. That would also explain things like I said to Jeff, like when you're measuring along the system and suddenly something changes, like what caused that to change in the physical system? Well, you know, one thing could be, like you said, you're applying a large bias voltage, perhaps you're tunneling electrons into the system. It's one option, and that could explain something like that. Yeah. Okay.
All right, let's thank Felix again.
Thanks.